Thomas said a demonstration involving hundreds of protesters would shut down the Mall of America.
You know, I don't remember the kind of life before what's going on. Like, you know, all of my activities have to do with basically what we call the revolution. You kind of just dive in it head first. It's like, so you can't stop. And, you know, I feel like if I stop this time, I can no longer complain about anyone that's murdered unarmed after, you know, Akai Gurley and Eric Garner and Mike Brown. So I have to keep going with this. Martin Luther King, I mean, he was in the movement for 13 years before he was assassinated. So it's not something that's going to be overnight. The significance to me of Black Lives Matter is that it's something that's nationwide. It's not just a New York problem. It's a New Jersey problem. It's across the United States. And, you know, Black Lives Matter is basically calling attention that, hey, you know, you say that all lives matter, and yes, all lives matter, but black lives aren't mattering right now. So that's what we're trying to let you guys know is, hey, you know, hi, black lives matter. You know, we're being kind of hunted, and it's a little bit of a pattern. At first, you know, people could say maybe it was a coincidence, but now it's just a pattern. And it's almost like every year there's some, you know, publicly broadcasted, you know, murder of an unarmed African-American or brown person.
Well, I moved to New York in November for work. I'm an attorney. I work in banking and financial compliance. But I've always been really active outside of work in, like, activists and social justice missions. I don't think people want to confront the issue that there's an issue with our system, that our police, not all of them, but there are some within those ranks, are brutalizing and terrorizing American citizens. And so I believe in our Constitution. I do believe in our criminal justice system. I think it, you know, it has the potential to be a great system, but the corruption within it and the bias within it makes it a very dangerous system for black and brown people.
Our justice system is not corrupt. It's just very decentralized in comparison to other democratic countries. And when it's decentralized, it's based on a variety of standards for people who are part of the system. And some of the standards are not as high as we would like them to see. And then people paint with a very broad brush, extrapolating from one jurisdiction to another. Definitely we have race issues in our society, not just in the United States, in many other countries. Police officers are recruited from the society and from the community. So there's no doubt in my mind that some of the officers have various biases.
On February 26, 2012, in Sanford, Florida, Trayvon Martin, an unarmed 17-year-old high school student coming home from a nearby convenience store, was fatally shot by George Zimmerman, a neighborhood watch captain. Martin died from a single gunshot wound to the chest. When police arrived at the scene, Zimmerman admitted that he shot Martin, but he claimed he had acted in self-defense. No charges were initially brought against Zimmerman. It was not until the shooting garnered national attention that Zimmerman was charged in connection with Martin's death. In July 2013, a jury acquitted Zimmerman of all charges. Upon the not guilty verdict, there were protests nationwide in more than 100 cities. President Obama said that he identified with the boy. Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago.
Why was it that Trayvon tended to fizzle out? One reason was because he got all of that rage that was finally manifest. But it was geared toward what? Laws, stand your ground. It wasn't geared toward the powers that be. It wasn't geared toward the federal government. It wasn't geared toward the White House. It was geared toward state laws. Well, why is that so? Well, that's exactly what the powers that be wanted it to be. You see, the president's office, what did he do? He sent his own extension, who was Sharpton. And Sharpton gives a great speech, and it's all about state laws rather than police going to jail. Everybody knows that you're not going to change arbitrary police power until policemen start going to jail. Why is it that in the last 7 years you haven't had one policeman go to jail? It's the same reason why you haven't had one Wall Street executive go to jail. Because the government doesn't want them to go to jail. The government don't want to put power in that direction to go to jail. You can rest be assured. If you had a massive network of poor people engaged in gangster activity like Wall Street did with market manipulation and insider trading, those folk gonna get caught and go to jail. You can rest be assured that the police were killing well-to-do white folk. Some police was going to jail. It's a priority. It's not a priority of the U.S. government to send policemen to jail. Not until it starts affecting them in the way it already affects many of us. And you see, some of us believe that the life of a poor black person, a poor brown person, has exactly the same value as that of a well-to-do white or well-to-do black or anybody else on the other side.
We did have officers jailed for excessive force, especially in we had a case, an infamous case in Charleston in South Carolina, when the officer shot an individual in his back, and he's right now in prison. The judicial system is not designed to avoid prosecution of police officers, but because the standard is a standard of discretion of the individual police officer, and the standard is based on, again, individual perceptions of the situations, it appears sometimes that there is injustice because we look at this behavior in hindsight, and for us, it appears as excessive. But for the officer, at the given moment on the street, it wasn't excessive. And the jurors frequently accept the word of the officer.
There is growing outrage tonight after an unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by police in the St. Louis suburb of Ferguson, Missouri.
There was a struggle, and one of the men pushed the officer into his car.
Within the police car, there was a struggle over the officer's weapon. There was at least one shot fired within the car.
The struggle spilled out onto the street where Brown, whom investigators say was not armed, was fatally shot.
Police have shot this man for no reason.
A little more than a year later, Michael Brown, an 18-year-old unarmed African-American man, was shot and killed in Ferguson, Missouri, a northern suburb of St. Louis. Brown, who had stolen several packages of cigarillos from a nearby convenience store shortly before the shooting, was confronted by 28-year-old Darren Wilson, a white Ferguson police officer. The disputed circumstances of the Brown shooting sparked unrest in the majority black city, and protests erupted. The events received considerable attention in the U.S. and elsewhere, and generated a vigorous debate about the relationship between law enforcement and African Americans, as well as the use of force by police in Missouri and across the nation.
In Ferguson, Michael Brown case, it's the word of the police officer, and we don't have any footage. The only footage that we have is what happened before at the convenience store. The footage at the convenience store is not very, positive in terms of how I look at this. It shows somebody who is acting very aggressively within the convenience store, and it gives me an indication that there was some level of violence that was displayed.
The Black Lives Matter movement focuses primarily on the experience of black men and has shaped the conversation about police brutality, where it occurs, and how it's addressed. But black women are also being killed, assaulted, and victimized by police. Women are often targeted in the same way as men, through shootings, police stops, and racial profiling. A growing number of Black Lives Matter activists, including the women behind the original hashtag, have been refocusing attention on how African American women and other marginalized communities are treated by the police. They're not only highlighting the impact racial discrimination has on their communities, but articulating why a movement for racial justice must be inclusive. Women have been at the forefront of organizing marches, die-ins, protests, and various initiatives to have their voices heard. Young African American women have been playing a central role.
cops are not supposed to be the judge, jury, and executioner. That's the end of the story, really.
Like, say hypothetically one or two of these shootings are justified. They don't even give us that opportunity to think, you know, critically about it, because regardless of what happens in the situation, they're not held accountable, which is the part that bothers me the most. It's like, regardless of what's happening, if it's a little boy, unarmed, kid sleeping, a grown man, you know, selling cigarettes, no matter what the police does to them, they're not being held accountable for it.
And there's no data. That's another big issue that I think when we have the demands, I mean, because I like Esther's, her list of demands. They kind of just echo what everyone's kind of feeling in the movement. But there needs to be data, because why can't we find any, you know, data about how many police-involved shootings, how many fatalities, how many were armed, how many weren't armed? We need that kind of information.
That's a serious issue. I think we need to really capitalize on, like, the momentum that we have here.
Yeah.
And definitely use that to engage the young people, because those are the people who are going to make a change. And that's why we have to do this at a local level. You know what I'm saying? We have to focus locally. And I think, like, our demonstrations, the vigil being one of them, is a good way to do that. You know what I'm saying? Just re-engage people at a local level and then help them to see that we can make change. So thank you guys, as always, for going out and supporting Erica night after night. I mean, we do that weekly, on a weekly basis, two nights a week. So when one of us can't get there, I appreciate that somebody is there to support her.
There.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
On July 17th, 2014, almost 1 year after George Zimmerman was acquitted in connection with the shooting death of Trayvon Martin, Eric Gardner, a 43-year-old father of six, died of a heart attack while in police custody. He was being arrested when a New York Police Department officer, Daniel Pantaleo, put Gardner in a chokehold. Gardner was arrested on a Staten Island street corner on suspicion of selling untaxed cigarettes. After Gardner resisted being arrested, Pantaleo pulled Gardner to the ground by the neck and placed him into a fatal chokehold. In a cell phone video taken by a passerby, Gardner, who suffered from chronic asthma and heart problems, repeatedly says, "I can't breathe," 11 times in total. This video has been viewed more than 2.5 million times. A grand jury declined to indict Officer Pantaleo, and he remains with the NYPD.
On July 17th, my father was out here just like another regular day, you know, talking with his friends. That day, I was at work. I worked in Long Island at that time. I got a call from my mom. I was talking to my mom. And then about 5-10 minutes after I got off the phone with my mom, my sister calls, and she's like, you know, she don't know what's going on. She's, my mom is, you know, all hysterical, crying. She don't know what's going on. They just said, "Dad, just stop breathing." So she started calling, you know, the hospital, trying to figure out what was going on. We couldn't get no information in from the phone. They called her and told her, you know, that it was something that went down and my dad stopped breathing. You know, she didn't know that it had anything to do with the cops until she got to the hospital. And so by the time we came to Staten Island, me, my aunt, and my cousins, you know, we drove past this part of where it happened, and we seen a whole bunch of news vans and yellow tape, and we still didn't know what was going on. So we got to my grandmother's house, and that's when a reporter from the Daily News was there, and he told us, you know, it was a confrontation with the cops, and there's a video, and would you guys like to see it before it goes out on the internet? And would you give us permission to let it go out? And me and my brothers and sisters sat on around the computer, watched the video, and it changed our lives forever. I couldn't stop. Like, I couldn't stop wondering why. You know, I was screaming at the TV, because, you know, in a matter of seconds, you see him, you know, being killed, murdered right before our eyes. And it was just horrible for us to see. I mean, we couldn't go into the living room and describe what we've seen on the TV, on the computer to our grandparents or to my mother, because it was so horrible. Like, I was sick that day. I mean, I just, you know, my whole body, it was just, like, shaky. It was, I just couldn't believe. And then when me and my aunt was driving back to Brooklyn, we stopped over here after all the cops left and everything. And people noticed me. I never been to Staten Island like that. Like, I stayed in Brooklyn. But my father used to talk a lot about me and his granddaughter. And when they noticed my face, that I looked like my dad, you know, the love was just pouring out. You know, people was telling me their versions of the story, and it was just like, wow. I still can't believe this happened.
The Eric Garner case is problematic in the sense that experts in martial arts and some other people who specialize in takedowns of individuals believe that this was more of a takedown than a chokehold. Part of the problem is the patrol guide or operating procedures, standard operating procedures of NYPD that were very broad. They were changing now. The use of force procedures have been changed since Eric Garner case.
A recent study on children, published in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, found that black boys as young as 10 are more likely to be mistaken as being older, be thought of as guilty of possible crimes, and face police violence if accused of a crime. According to a ProPublica analysis of federally collected data on fatal police shootings, young black males were 21 times more likely to have been shot dead by police than their white counterparts. The 1,217 deadly police shootings from 2010 to 2012 captured in the federal data show that black males, ages 15 to 19, died at the hands of police at a rate of 31.17 per million. White males in the same age range were killed at a rate of just 1.47 per million.
Breaking news tonight, it was a case that sparked outrage across the nation and heartbreak here in Cleveland. 12-year-old Tamir Rice playing with a gun outside a rec center. The gun turned out to be fake, and he was shot to death by a rookie police officer who says that he thought it was real. Now the Cuyahoga County prosecutor has released three brand new reports on this shooting just within the past few hours. One is from the Highway Patrol. The other two are from experts asked to weigh in on this case months ago. They both found that the officer was justified. So who are these experts and how did they reach this decision?
In November 2014, 12-year-old Tamir Rice was shot and killed by a police officer in Cleveland, Ohio. Two officers, Timothy Lohman and Frank Garnback, were responding to a 911 call reporting that a man in a neighborhood park was walking around with what was described as probably a fake gun. Just 1.5 seconds after arriving on the scene, Officer Lohman shot and killed Rice. The boy had been playing with what was later identified as an airsoft pellet gun. A video obtained by the Northeast Ohio Media Group shows Rice's 14-year-old sister running over to her brother, being tackled and forced to the ground, handcuffed, and placed in a patrol car while her brother lay dying. The video also shows that police waited 4 minutes before providing any first aid to Rice. On June 3, 2015, the county sheriff's office released a statement saying their investigation had been completed, with their findings turned over to the county prosecutor. A grand jury later declined to indict Officer Lohman.
When we talk about law enforcement, we talk about 18,000 different police departments in the United States. Most of the departments that I'm familiar with, they don't have specific training for police officers to deal with minors and toy guns. It's mentioned during sometimes roll call, sometimes during the basic academy, that of course there's a possibility. But again, police officers are like any other people. They fear. They have more fear probably than an average person, because they also see situations that are much more dangerous and and horrific than an average person. They're not taught or trained how to control their fears.
As you know, Black Lives Matter is a multiracial movement. Because if Black Lives Matter, then all lives will matter. Because usually it's the Black lives that are the last ones to have that.
Even within our own nation, the consciousness has been raised. People were preaching about colorblindness. They realized that there are race issues that are still permeate our society.
I don't want my children to experience it. You know, I don't want them to grow up being afraid or teaching them to be afraid of police.
There is just as much anger out here.
These police officers in riot gear trying to hold this position at Camden and Howard.
Again, we're seeing the African American justice facing police in a
just going over some things for the vigil. It's going to be in Nicholas Hayward Jr. Park. That's in Brooklyn. He was murdered by the police, 13-year-old murdered by the police for like really similar circumstances, very close parallel to what was happening with what happened with Tamir Rice. So it's important for me, I think, that place be chosen and that his story be highlighted. So to that end, I'm always trying to connect the dots so that people see, yes, this is a national issue, but this is also a local issue. So his father's going to be speaking. We'll have a prayer by Pastor Omar, words from Mr. Hayward, and then I'll close out talking about the national epidemic of police violence against children. And this is why I wanted us to meet, so that we could talk about things that I may be overlooking. Well, for one, I've applied for a PIT permit with the Parks Department. You guys know that's always important to me, but I also wanted to get your input on that. We had issues with the permit with the march, lots of fighting with the Parks Department and the Police Department. And so they haven't been responsive yet, so I'm wondering if we're going to encounter the same issues that we did with the 4-mile march. The reason why I choose places of public accommodation is because we have a legal right to be there. And so, like, you know, there's nothing that they can really do about us exercising our First Amendment right within a space of public accommodation.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Asma. I have the honor to be your host once more and you are listening to Muslim Lady. This is the cozy corner for all the ladies out there. Wherever you are, I hope you're doing just well. So, as usual, we have our very dear lady to help us with the insights, and she is Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum, sister, and welcome.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming here.
I am Tarfadlan Zainab Askari. actually from Kashmir, and I've been studying Hausa here for the last 10 years, and I'm also authoring one or two books on Muslim lady.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for coming here and for cooperating. So we have many narrations, many numerous narrations, encouraging the families to go for the proposers who actually have got the best manners and they are religious people. I would ask you a personal question. Imagine for your future girl, there comes a proposer. One of them, one of the proposers, is wealthy, yet you're not sure about their religion. The other one is actually not wealthy, but very religious. And when I say religious, don't take that literal, because sometimes religiosity does not show on your appearance, and it is in the way you act.
In your conduct.
Yeah, in your conduct, actually. Which one would you rather to pick for your daughter? Or encourage her to go for that one.
Of course, what Lady Khadija salam alayha did. She was a business tycoon herself. And
she was already wealthy.
Yeah, she was already wealthy, and she always had wealthy suitors for her.
Exactly.
But then the one she chose was because of the religion, and not, again, on the apparent basis, but in his conduct during the business trip they had, and the way she saw, like, how faithful. Sometimes
her criterion was actually the trustworthiness of the prophet.
Yes, so yeah, definitely, like, if I was at that place, I would definitely, like, if today we have the same situation, I would definitely go with the same thing. Like, I remember even like when my husband's family came as suitors for me, we had many people before that, and like some were like working in the UAE, some were working in other Middle Eastern countries, and this was not the first one like who was studying abroad or something, like they were like quite wealthy than him. The thing that my father liked was, well, my father was standing at the door, and his sister, she said, "Ya Allah," like, rather than telling him, like, "Excuse me, can you go get aside, or I want to get inside." And my father was really impressed with this, and he said, like, "Did you notice, like, she didn't talk to me, she didn't tell me, can you get aside, excuse me, or something." And the beautiful thing she said, "Ya Allah," and how, you know, spiritual our home became by this "Ya Allah," and how spiritual this marriage can be. And a lot of things, like, later on, like, when he saw my husband for the first time, they went outside together, and then they were driving, and he stops at one of the roads, and then he picks up the stone, keeps it aside while he had already crossed the road. And my father was like, "See, like, we had crossed, but yet, like, so that others do not get into trouble, I'm like, I am okay with this person. I know that they are not much financially."
But do you
well.
Think that but, yeah. everybody is like, I just want to be more realistic. Like, in today's world, for girls, if they are given the choice of the wealthy man who is not religious apparently, and then the other man who is religious yet unwealthy, they wouldn't.
Which is very common, actually.
Yeah, which is very common. They wouldn't actually go for the religious one. And then they would tell you, why do we have to care for religiosity? I want to clarify this point, that why spirituality of a person, why the religiosity of a person is very important.
It is the basic criterion to choose a spouse in Islamic teachings. Like, according to the Holy Quran, the most important criterion for a suitable spouse is faith. And there are so many other things, like, you know, there are so many other criteria, like how much importance they give to the acts of worship, what is the family background, and the righteous friends. Friends are very important. Like, it's also seen, like, what kind of friends he hangs out with. And also, they should have appropriate dress, appropriate character, modest. Modesty, where does that modesty, where does your dressing sense comes from? The religion. And all the differences I think people have over is the religion things.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear ladies. I hope you're still following us and the insights Sister Zainab is sharing with us about the topic of marrying the one who is already a religious man and not necessarily a wealthy man, apparently, by the way. So you're listening to IRB English Radio. This is Asma, and Sister Zainab is here, and she's talking about the fact that religiosity and the spirituality of a man is all that a woman must search for.
Because the religion gives you the path, and because of religion you are able to decide, like, when you wake up, when you sleep, how you wake up, how you sleep.
It gives you a conduct book.
Complete conduct book.
Yeah. So for the question I asked, for the girl who comes to you and then tells you, why do I have to care for religiosity of a man? Isn't humanity enough?
I would say the...
Because, you know, in today's world, in the modern world, we have this religion of humanity.
Yeah, unfortunately. Because I think the goal has been just this world. Like, it's important to take blessings from this world and use them and to work and to, you know, provide sustenance for your family. Everything is important, but this world should not be the ultimate goal. Those who look at this world as an ultimate goal, they get stuck. For example, it said that, it's a beautiful story, it said that there was a man who fell in a well, but he holds a rope, and down in the well, there's a big snake whose mouth is open. And above the well, there are two mouses, black and white, and they are trying to cut the rope. And now he's confused, and all of a sudden he sees the honey on the side of a well, and he gets, he gets distracted with the honey. And this is dunya. This is the world. This is the attractions of the world. This is that humanity. This is that wealthiness and all. The black and white masses represent the day and night, and this rope is your life.
Exactly.
And the snake, with open mouth down in the well, is the grave, right? So this should not be forgotten. Like, our ultimate destiny is somewhere else. What I have to take there, like, how much wealth I will
be. Do not be distracted by the honey.
Yeah.
And because eventually you're going to end up in that snake's mouth.
And I think the more the religion makes you human, the humanity itself won't be able to make you more human. So, like, religion is all about humanity.
And we have to know that humanity has got some borders, and to some extent it might be selfish at some points because it is humanity. But religion does not have any selfishness in itself.
Right, and it does not contradict with humanity at, like, many stages.
It includes humanity, but humanity in itself may not include religiosity and spirituality.
Exactly, so this makes it quite important. And I would also say, like, why is it important? Like, for example, since the culture we come from, for example, you might have known that India is a country which has got most of the religions of the world.
Yeah.
Right? So there are so many interfaith marriages there. We witnessed that. I personally come from Kashmir. And in Kashmir, we have like 90% of Muslims. For example, Allah conquers all up to when. Like, if you have, if you try to go through it, like, very, very positively, still, till the moment you have a child, then the naming of a child, then rearing a child.
The upbringing of the child.
Exactly, like we witnessed. And then, like, when my mother's friend used to say this very beautiful thing, and this is so true, I would like to quote her. She would say that, and I was once talking to her on phone, and I was like, what happens to that love concourse of things, and why does that love disappear after?
It has a limit.
After things start, showing themselves up, after, like, people face realistic things in their lives. And she was like, love before marriage is exactly like the soda water. There are these beautiful bubbles and that pop up.
That's a very beautiful analogy.
Yeah. And those bubbles do pop up once they are into the marriage. So don't think about what happened to that love that was not love, that was a soda water. And literally it is. We have seen that. So before this, you know, before you're getting for into community marriage or into faith marriage, you should definitely see that. Is that a soda water or something like that? Because everything starts with your gaze. And in Quran, we have been told, lower your gaze. First to men and then to believing women. They are told to cover themselves in a way. And if that thing is practiced, actually, you know, nothing like that, the love before marriage would appear. And actual love happens basically after marriage.
Until there would be no persistent temptation, like, to get into something that you shouldn't get into.
Yeah, because, like, before that, people try to show you only the best version of themselves. They would never tell you where do they, how unorganized they are. They would never show you where do they throw their socks when they come home. They would never show you any other, you know, all those flaws they
carry.
The
unmasked version of themselves. Exactly. Like us human beings, we have many masks on our faces. But these masks are going to be put off of our face.
Yeah.
Right at the moment when we get into the same house, the same room, like having constant interaction with each other, that would be once I little by little start to mask off.
Exactly. And if that pops up like that bubble, it's as Shakespeare says, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds.
Exactly. Very true. Religiosity is important even for those people who do not believe that religion is an important factor. Why? Because those who believe in a religion, they've got a God who believe that he's watching over them. And since that Almighty is watching over them, they would be very careful of and cautious of every single step they take. So the person who's already aware of an Almighty is technically more trustworthy than the one who does not believe in any other, in any actually superpower, in any Almighty.
Right.
So these guys would be pretty much more human in the sense of humanity, like they would be caring more for humanity because these are the precious creatures of God. They would take more care of you as their spouses. So yes, thank you, Sister Zainab, and thank you, dear ladies. This was all the time that we had for today. I hope you have enjoyed that. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free. Searching for the light, and you see no hope in sight. Be sure and have no doubt, he is always close to you. He's the one who knows you best. He knows what's in your heart. You'll find your peace at last if you just have faith in him. You're always in my heart and mind. Your name is mentioned every day. No matter what, my biggest wish is to see you one day, 'cause I believe.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuning to Iran Radio broadcast from Tehran. Today is Wednesday, and here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran. In total, 25 prophets are mentioned in the Holy Quran in different chapters. Prophet Moses, or Musa in Arabic, peace be upon him, is mentioned 136 times in the Holy Quran, making him the most mentioned prophet of all in the Holy Book of Allah. The literal meaning of the word Quran is the which is being read. The word Quran is repeated 70 times in the Book of Allah itself. The month of Ramadan is the only month of the year mentioned in Quran in verse 185 of chapter Al-Baqarah, or second chapter. Now we'll listen to the continuation of our schedule on Iran Radio. We start off this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. After that, we have Islamic Laws. The program focuses on Islamic laws and adopts a practical approach to the subject. Next up will be our varied radio productions feature again. Stay with us for this hour.
Pro-Palestine supporters in the UK are paying a high price for their opposition to the Western-backed genocide in Gaza. One of the loudest advocates of Palestinian liberation has been NHS doctor and trainee orthopedic and trauma surgeon Dr. Rame Aladwan, who's found herself in the crosshairs of a powerful smear campaign orchestrated by the cheerleaders for the genocide. In case you're wondering why a noted medic would be facing the wrath of the British police and by extension the British state, you'll have to go back to the weeks and months after October the 7th. Thanks to her vocal opposition to what Dr. Aladwan calls Jewish supremacy, she's become a target of the pro-Israel lobby, spearheaded by UK Lawyers for Israel. Other Zionist organizations and trolls piled on, kick-starting a campaign of harassment and intimidation.
If you don't like controversy but still want the facts, then keep watching. This NHS story is making...
Not satisfied with their online hate campaign, the new target became Dr. Aladwan's medical license. Under extreme lobbying from pro-Israel groups, the General Medical Council, the GMC, launched a nine-month investigation. When the case was concluded with the GMC finding there was no charge to answer, that should have been the end of the matter. Except it wasn't. Days later, a new case was raised, and this time, at a GMC tribunal in Manchester, England, Dr. Aladwan emerged victorious.
Today felt like a huge responsibility, number one, to the Palestinian people, because any loss to us, when we know our hearts, we know that we are standing for goodness, you know, we are standing for justice, we know this. But secondly, this big responsibility of they're attacking me as a doctor, as a healthcare worker. And therefore, if they can say that what I said is not acceptable, even though I fully know that it's legitimate, that means that all of my fellow healthcare workers will then feel that they cannot say what I said. But that's not happened. So they don't really have they don't have an excuse now. So I encourage the movement to progress the conversation and to take, you know, not so much inspiration, but just take the evidence of this. I was branded as the Jewish supremacy doctor, you know, so many newspapers from the Jewish supremacists, the Israel lobby, Jewish supremacists, they tell us what they don't want us to say, yeah? And that was that made the over a third of my complaint bundle was about Jewish supremacy. Me saying so they had searched Jewish supremacy and then just taken a screenshot of all the times I've said it. So you can see why they don't want me to say it, because it's effective and it's factual. So I think it's I hope that people now progress and use this, and are not so scared. You know, yeah.
It was a giant bloody nose for the pro-Israel lobby. But they, and Britain's political acolytes would not concede. If the current laws were not fit for purpose, the British state would simply cook up some new ones. Weeks after her original victory to retain her medical license, livelihood and reputation, there was a new case brought to strip Dr. Rame Aladwan of all those things.
You know, the attacks, at first they felt, okay, this is the UK pro-Israel lobby attacking me. But as it progressed, now it feels like the British state is attacking me. Especially with the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, getting involved, the press. You know, the attacks culminated with the pro-Israel lobby and what I say are Jewish supremacists, you know, that's what I call Zionists, groups and individuals. But now it is more of the British state. But, you know, it has forced me to slow my life down, my career being behind. Now over 2 years, and of course I had plans, I had been saving up, I helped support my family, I have been saving up to buy a home, and yeah, for those 2 years, yes, I have had to use most of my savings to keep myself and my family afloat. The way that I see this fight right now, even against what is becoming sort of me and my fellow healthcare workers and anti-genocide, pro-Palestine British citizens, I still see that I'm fighting for Britain. And there are tiny moments where I think, okay, as a Palestinian, I'm literally, the entire point is that I'm fighting to stop this Holocaust. You know, we are all fighting for Palestine. Why sort of do I have to do this fight? Why is Britain attacking me? Well, like, as far as I know, I've not done anything to hurt Britain or any British person. But the overriding feeling is that I'm still fighting for my fellow British people and their rights. And I guess as Palestinians, we just have to fight. I said this on X. We fight as Palestinians. We fight for our rights and the rights of those around us, wherever we are.
The frenzy surrounding this case had reached fever pitch. Having returned to the family home in Bristol, the site of her arrest, Dr. Aladwan reflected on the scale of vitriol and why it made no sense.
I never even expected that I would be where I am right now, being attacked for speaking about Palestine. I think a lot of people like might feel like they've had this struggle all their lives, and I think that that's completely normal. I think for me, I think maybe I didn't run into trouble. I just thought this was a normal thing, and that's just who I am and what I do. So I'd wear the kufiya, I'd wear the, you know, and I'd post about it. And I never thought that not only people who are pro-Israel or, you know, Zionist Jewish supremacists would have an issue. So I didn't think about that because I thought, well, you say what you want. You know, you post the Israeli flag and you say whatever you want. I don't come to attack you. I just leave you alone. We don't cross paths. So to think that it's actually gotten to the point where I'm being, you know, there's a demand for me to lose my medical license because I'm speaking about Palestine or just upholding our principles of liberation, our thawabit. All of those beliefs and all of those things that I've felt and known and had my entire life, they're also not illegal. Like, I'm not saying anything illegal. I'm not inciting harm or violence. I'm not attacking anybody in particular. I haven't gone for anyone who is pro the terrorist entity, or I'm just using my freedom of expression and speech. But for me, as Rahmi, nothing has changed. But somehow, I'm now in this climate where the British state is siding with Israel just to literally silence me, to say what you've said now is too much. And I'm always thinking, I haven't said anything different. Like, I'm not sort of escalating. I'm not saying anything more radical, or I say, as I call it, principled. But you somehow have such a huge issue. Now, I was in the newspaper yesterday, The Telegraph. They didn't ask me for a comment, actually, but they said, I think the headline was Doctor Who, quote unquote, denied Holocaust. You know, they say that because I say that what's happening in Gaza is a Holocaust. You know, it is practically illegal to deny the Holocaust trademark, right? But the fact that I call it that, so they say, quote unquote, denied Holocaust, celebrates October 7 attack. And I thought, what I posted was, glory to the breaking of the 17-year-long illegal siege on Gaza, and glory to our martyrs. And I said, I will never condemn. I posted my ex post from April, saying I will never condemn the 7th of October. So I haven't said these things. I've said so many times. I've posted them. They're out there, but the attack is so severe for some reason. It's almost like they are trying to paint this picture that will somehow qualify that I should not treat British patients. And I find it so bizarre because I'm the same. People who know me in real life know that there's nothing different here. But that's why I posted today and I said, you know, they keep smearing me and defaming me, but they don't interview me. You know, they don't ask me to come on and speak to them so that the British public can hear me.
Even open an investigation, yet here I am, a second investigation and a second hearing. This is a double jeopardy.
At the heart of the case against her is the safety of Jewish patients in Dr. Ladwan's care. Despite the fact in her years of practicing, there had previously been zero complaints. It's clear that it's her vocal anti-genocide stance that is the issue, not her ability to treat her patients with care and respect.
I am campaigning against supremacy. I don't know why they think saying Jewish supremacy is somehow offensive. It's the supremacy part is the offensive. I'm literally saying Jews are equal to everybody else, which again is so tiring, right? Because I'm trying to say stop murdering Palestinians, right? But you're keep wanting to center the safety of Jews who are safe. Okay, so Jewish patients are safe. Nobody's harmed them. Okay, so no pro-Palestine anti-genocide healthcare worker or doctor has harmed a Jewish patient. Yeah, we are being politically persecuted for words with this imaginary threat. What you're saying is there's a threat to Jewish supremacy that makes me a danger. And somehow I am a danger to patients. You know, I can't, you know, how could you treat me? You've got somebody who's saying there should be no apartheid. Yeah, we treat everybody equally. We're all equal. If you're non-Jew, if you're Jew, if you're whatever you are equal, right? Why is calling for equality and, you know, being against genocide somehow? Is that the Britain that we want? Is that the Britain? That's not the Britain that I thought I'd be living in 2025. Britain that says I cannot be a doctor if I am against supremacy and apartheid. But that's what they're trying to do. This is the fight that we're up against, and it's really sad. It's really, really sad. They can't prove that I've ever harmed a patient, because I haven't, or ever been prejudiced. And all of the other doctors and healthcare workers that they've attacked, they can't prove it. But if they succeed, which they won't, because we'll fight them, but if they succeed in removing us from the medical profession, what will happen is you'll have a medical, you'll end up having an environment in healthcare in Britain where the people who were the most outspoken about the worst crimes ever that we've seen are no longer there. And I think that's the most dangerous part of all. If they start to introduce more of Palantir that is taking our patient data, you know, this is a company that we know is involved with the Israeli occupation forces, if they, the privatization, any sort of corruption in the NHS, if the people there now have not spoken out against the mass murder of children, what guarantee do you have that they'll speak about that or stand against that? Because we will. You're guaranteed that we will. But if we're gone, then you're going to have what they want is the obedient, head down. Being a doctor, being a healthcare worker is a checklist. You do what you need to do. You're a shift worker. You go home, and that's so separate. But that's not what medicine. That's not the medicine. That's not why I became a doctor. That's not what medicine is. Healthcare is not just my list of jobs. It isn't just the operation I'm about to do. Yeah, it is. It you have a role in the society. You have a duty for to your fellow humans. If you care about the sanctity of life, and you really, you know, if you're a real doctor, then you're a doctor at all times, not just when you're prescribing a medication.
The harassment and targeting of the livelihoods and careers of other pro-Palestinian voices was now the blueprint of the Israeli lobby in the UK. When online harassment failed to lead to capitulation, the next step was a full-scale move to get these groups and individuals removed from their jobs, lose record deals, sponsorships, whatever it would take to shut them up.
Why?
The fact that Dr. Ladwan's arrest on trumped-up charges came just hours before she was supposed to face a tribunal for the second time in a matter of weeks was not coincidental. A night in the cells did nothing to dampen her resolve.